Protecting what matters on the right choice, AM 1230 KPRL 99.3 FM with Barry Fisher. Advice and information on protecting what matters most in today's world. Brought to you by Adler Belmont Insurance Brokers and their new associate, Heather Bordan, serving the commercial insurance needs of businesses on the Central Coast.
It's Tuesday. It's 12:30. The bear is in the building. It's time for Protecting What Matters. PWM is the broadcast that helps you become better shoppers and buyers of services and products to protect various aspects of your life, health, and property. We also explore current events, our history, community, institutions, and local treasures that are notable and worth preserving. We have two great guests today. Our first in-studio guest is Ryan Rundle, president of the Cal Poly College Republicans and Turning Point USA. We're going to talk about Cal Poly's early wave Gen Zers as they take the stage in the local conservative movement, issues most important to young college students and the divide between men and women, and recent and upcoming Cal Poly College Republican TPS USA events. Ryan, welcome to Protecting What Matters.
Thank you so much for having me on, Barry.
I'm happy to have you on here. And then at 1 o'clock, we're going to have my old friend calling in. It is a very, very timely segment. You're not going to want to miss Stephen Moses, who is the president for the Center for Long-Term Care Reform and visiting fellow at Paragon Health. We're going to be talking about Medicaid, or in California called Medi-Cal, fraud, why it's bad for taxpayers and patients, the latest research on aging well from age wave guru Ken Dykewald, and then insights in artificial intelligence and its increasing role in long-term care services. Call in with questions or comments, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. So, Ryan, you're my first Gen Z victim on PWM. Thanks for being game for this. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad to bridge the gap.
You know? Well, I have a feeling if you stay in town after you graduate, you might become a regular, but we'll see how that goes, huh?
Yeah, I sure hope so.
Where are you from originally?
So I'm originally from Southern California, so Lake Arrowhead, okay. California. So 9 kids in my graduating class, you know, living near the lake, middle of the forest. So this is, you know, Cal Poly to me is very much like the Big Apple, which is, you know, 30,000 students, but, you know, miles bigger than anything I grew up with.
There you go. And what brought you up to Cal Poly?
Learn by doing.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like the land of opportunity, you know. Work hard. My parents went to Cal Poly Pomona, so they, you know, they believed in the program, and, you know, business program is really awesome here. So, you know, that's why I came up here.
So you're a business major?
Yes, sir. Business administration student with a minor in sales.
And what got you into politics?
So I started off with politics. You know, obviously, I always like just staying in tune with stuff. And I think a lot of Gen Z students individuals kind of fell into it. I think COVID was a big reason why people started staying tuned. You know, they were all forced to stay home. And, well, why are they forced to stay home? And, well, they had their iPads and they had their, you know, their phones and their and just like, all they could do is like tune in online and see what was happening. So I think that's where I really, really started staying in tune of actual politics. And then I'd say I had a couple opportunities where I actually ran into or met Charlie Kirk.
Oh, really?
And so actually, I would say for me, the biggest thing is that I really resonated with what he was saying. And a lot of people who never got to meet him, you know, they just hear sound clips online. But I think like actually getting to meet him and talk to him, like actually, he really, like, that really resonated with me. And so that's kind of what got me involved, was wanting to, you know, freedom of speech, standing up, being a leader, that kind of stuff.
Good. I want to talk more about that in a minute, okay? But first, because that's one of my questions coming up, but one of the things that I did want to talk to you about, again, and I shared this with you, the audience is painfully aware that I'm a fan of Neil Howe and the fourth turning stuff, the history of generational history.
Yeah.
And I just think it's really cool that you are an early wave Gen Zer, a Zoomer, mm-hmm. we'll call you. And one of the first things that I'm reading here off of my cheat sheet is how emphasizes the Gen Zers have no memories of a confident, booming America. Their childhood has been dominated by the war on terror, the Great Recession, slow recoveries, polarization, school shootings, and the pandemic. Okay, would that pretty much describe you?
Yeah, I would say so. I know a lot of Gen Zers that, a saying that we've grown up with, it's not those kind of times anymore. I know a lot of our parents and grandparents, they were able to go out and go and, just leave the house and be gone all day. It's not that kind of world anymore. It's not as safe anymore. And I mean, I don't know. I feel like the statistics kind of show that things have gotten better. I mean, that's just from what I've seen. But I mean, I definitely know, especially with the media landscape where everyone's afraid, and a lot of us grew up with a more protected kind of, upraising.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that kind of delineates a generational cohort in this theory is your first recollection of something. So what mm-hmm. was your first recollection of something that really has kind of stuck with you since your early years? Because you were born around 2003, right?
Yeah.
So you don't remember the Twin Tower stuff and all the 2011 stuff. What were the first recollections?
Just like politically or just
events? I think it's a more event-oriented kind of thing. Or politics is fine.
Definitely COVID was honestly really big one. First, I don't personally remember this, but I know like me and my brother were both born during massive forest fires, so mm-hmm. I remember growing up in kind of the aftermath of a very crispy forest. but I would say definitely COVID was my big thing that I personally felt. The first cognitive memory I have of anything kind of different or interesting, actually, the first time I even registered politics existed was actually Trump winning the election. I just remember being at a hotel and people were like, wait, what? That actually happened? And then from there, I just, kind of started collecting more and more information. And then the most recent thing that I personally experienced was obviously the assassination of Charlie Kirk.
What about school shootings and so on and so forth? Did that make much of an impact on you?
We had a scare at our school, but it was actually a false flag, and it was just some kid that, someone really didn't like this one kid, so they tried framing him.
Mm-hmm.
And I do remember on the school side, I grew up in a public school and ended up switching to a private school in high school. Just a lot of brokenness and tension. Even just seeing the massive difference between when I was in elementary school, things felt great when I was in elementary. And then looking back and seeing the difference between the kids that were there with me versus the kids who came after me is drastic difference. I saw in real life time how the schooling system was kind of falling apart and people were fighting each other. Actually knocking them to the ground, paralyzing each other. Wow. It was craziness.
So what, from your perspective, now that you're, 22 almost, you're probably
22? 22.
All right. So what are the issues that most Gen Zers that you hang out with focused on? What are they really dealing with?
Yeah. So I know, obviously, I think everyone kind of feels the same. Just, the ability to, be able to buy their, live the American dream in the sense of being able to buy a house or being able to afford a gas or, I think a lot of Gen Zers want more personal freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't really buy into the same kind of, they don't buy into as much the big overall structure, but they have their own independent kind of, a lot of it's either social media or just independent different structures instead of being involved in these bigger organizations. I know it's interesting. I remember seeing a talk about, people normally they mature as they go through the different stages of life. And a lot of Gen Zers are kind of stuck at that stage of either even just trying to get a job or trying to get a house. And it is a lot harder. So a lot of Gen Z hasn't matured past that point to where they could even have a wife or kids or, being able to, they haven't gone through those later life steps, even if they are older.
You're right. Because, what about, what we hear a lot about the political differences and the attitudinal differences between Gen Z men and Gen Z women. What do you find happening on college campuses? Is the divide as big as it's reported to be?
It definitely feels like that. I feel like from what I've seen on Cal Poly campus, I like to call them closeted conservatives. There's a lot of people that I know that are conservative, that are, you know, lean more right, that are, you know, they're just blue collar kind of agriculture. They're just focusing on actually working their job and they're not getting involved in politics, or they do want to get involved, but they're concerned that if they are open about it, that they're going to be kind of harassed, which I've definitely seen a little bit about myself. It's not been like Cal Poly is actually a really good school, and like we have the platform to kind of have open conversations from all sides. But yeah, like they're definitely, to me, it is more of a social pressure that people feel, because there's like these huge cliques of like organizations and people. I think people are, a lot of people in California, especially Central Coast, are afraid to be seen as different. And when, you know, there's like a status quo. And so you do see a lot of people just kind of not talking about their beliefs. And I definitely do see a lot of the, on the women side, that there definitely is, I'd say, more left leaning on the women and then more right leaning on the right. But I mean, I have Democrat friends who are dudes, and I have Republican friends or a woman. So it's not like a perfect split by any means.
So have you ever had a gal tell you that she wouldn't go out with you because you're a conservative and you voted for Trump?
I mean, I definitely, I've never like asked someone out who has used that as the reason. I would definitely say, and obviously, you know, maybe they still don't like me as a person, but I would say mostly, I would say I'm more focused on, like, right now, just my stage of life. Mm-hmm. I'm really focused on setting myself up and becoming the person that could provide for a relationship. Mm-hmm. So I'm not just like massively trying to hammer that in right now.
Yeah.
One of the big things Charlie Kirk talked about that I resonate with is just basically as the man, like, your role is to work as hard as you can and be and to kind of take leadership. And a lot of dudes I think aren't taking as much leadership as they should be. So I'm really trying to be someone who can actually lead in a relationship, because I know a lot of people like to talk about the submit to your husbands. But what that means is that, you know, it's supposed to be someone who trusts in your leadership, but you have to have leadership that's worth trusting. So
right.
What I can do is be a leader that is worth following. And that it is an everyday battle.
So yeah. Why are some Gen Zers, you know, your friends, why are you, were you and they drawn to TPUSA and Charlie Kirk's message?
I think a lot of people resonate with Charlie Kirk because people are tired of being just told to believe something and to just assume what they assume that, you know, is just true. I think there's a massive distrust amongst like the media and even the political parties nowadays with Gen Z. And so I think for a lot of people, Charlie Kirk, where they had those open talks and conversations, is something that I would say was very appealing to people. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of, I mean, obviously a lot of Christians, not all of them are Christians, but a lot of Christians resonated on the side that they liked that he was very, you know, it came from a faith-based thing where, you know, going out there in the world and kind of talking truth in love is, mm-hmm. you know, that's very important, you know?
You know, my impression of certainly the Democrat socialist left, okay?
Yeah.
And I want your opinion. This is the question. You know, their focus is atomizing people, separating people into groups that don't mm-hmm. like each other, where Charlie Kirk's message was more of an inclusive thing. Let's talk about it and have a good time.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, is that a good characterization of the divide in some regards?
I would say it's a little bit more nuanced than that. Because I know there's people on the left that I've talked to who are very open and awesome, that like are totally willing to work with people. And then there's also people on the right who aren't. So again, mm-hmm. I think there is more nuance. I do think that Charlie Kirk was very much like like, let's take this idea and put it under a magnifying glass and see if it can actually hold its own weight. And it's interesting, though, because I think a lot of people who are trying to copy Charlie Kirk since his assassination, they forget the heart. You know, they do the debating without the heart.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely think that it is hard, because I think I've personally experienced on my side, it is really hard to get people to work together. And I've been really trying to, but, you know, just as my identity as a Turning Point president or a College Republicans president, like, sometimes people just have a natural distrusted that. And, you know, when I get to meet people and talk to them, like, people realize, oh, he's actually, like, a cool guy. Like, he doesn't mean anything. Like, he genuinely wants to have an open conversation. But I think that's just the natural assumption from people who disagree with Turning Point is that, like, we're not, which is not the case. Like, even within Turning Point, we have a variety of different beliefs. You know, people who are doing it because they're strong in Christian faith. There are people who are very much not Christian and they are believing in that. There's people who like Trump. There's people who really don't like Trump. You know, there's a good mix. Mm-hmm. So,
all right, real quick, this is a quick question because I wanted to get this one in because you brought it up. Are you seeing a religious revival amongst your generation?
Yeah, so I definitely think that is the case. I think we had a very long time of we need to remove religion from the world. Well, now people need something to believe in, right? And they're turning back to Christ. And mm-hmm. I think it's interesting, though. I think a lot of them are going traditionally Catholic, from what I've heard. I personally am like a non-denominational Christian. So, and from the different Christian groups I've talked with, a lot of them have said that people are generally very open to religion, but it's not necessarily just like Christianity, like this one brand of Christianity. It's more that people are looking for a bigger thing to believe in.
Well, if you get more into the Neil Howe stuff and the fourth turning stuff, you will see that in the next turning, which is an awakening, so to speak,
yeah.
the springtime in the season in our seculum, the beginning of the 80-year cycle, yeah. There's always a religious awakening in our history.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had that's happened sequentially over since before, even back into the days of England.
Yeah.
And so that's something to watch for. And I think that the Charlie Kirk TPUSA thing was really like the leading edge of that movement. Into the awakening. Real quick, we've got about a minute and a half left before the break here. Tell us a little bit about TPUSA, the Cal Poly Republicans, and how you became its leader.
Yeah, so it's actually a funny story. I basically became the leader because, and I think this is what actually Charlie's message was basically I was offered the opportunity and I said yes because all the graduating class was, you know, I mean, all the leaders were graduating and I was the one who stood up to the plate, and I think that's what kind of Charlie really, really taught was like, hey, it's not, you don't have to wait till someone tells you it's okay. Like, you just need to step up and say yes and just step up to being a leader, right? And so we've been really trying to, and people do assume that Turning Point is like a Christian like representation. So my thought was, I'm a Christian first and foremost. I want, if they're going to be representing Christianity, I want to be able to have it be a good represent and be Christ-like, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've worked a lot with different community members. It's been super awesome. Other events kind of like teaching about leadership, having kind of open conversations with different viewpoints. We've even had like different Christian speakers and talking, you know, and all this stuff is easy, right? Like some of the stuff is hard conversations, but, and you may not agree with them, but the important part is that we have open conversations and we're willing to listen to each other, you know, love and truth.
That's great. Well, I hear the bumper music, so we've got about a 2-minute break. And folks, I'll be right back on the other side of the break with Ryan Rundle.
Thank you so much. You're
not leaving yet. Cal Poly conservative leader. And we're looking forward to some more of his insights. So stand by. Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with Ryan Rundle, president of the Cal Poly College Republicans and Turning Point USA. You can call in or text questions, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. Just a real quick announcement here. I'll do this again at next hour, but RP Slow is doing a Rededicate 250 event on the 17th, this coming Sunday, at the Republican headquarters. They're looking for a small donation, and they're going to have a bevy of candidates and current office holders there to speak and network with. So this is a great opportunity for you to come and hang out and see what RP Slow has got going. You can get more information at www.rpslowloc.org. Okay, a couple more quick questions here, and then I want to move on to what you guys got coming up planning-wise. Number one, have you gotten any pushback from faculty or administration? Significant. I mean, has anything significant happened, or are you getting pretty much some support from general support?
I would definitely say that, you know, obviously we haven't been pulled any favors, per se, but I would say out of all the different colleges I've heard that, you know, Turning Point's been on, I would honestly say Cal Poly has been, like, the most fair to us. You know, they've never shut down any of our events, and, you know, you got to make sure you have all your paperwork on time, because we've learned that, you know, that they won't make any exceptions for that. But, you know, that's just status quo.
Okay.
They've been pretty open and fair to all, having an equal platform for all people. So.
Good. So nobody's trying to throw you off campus or get you shut down or anything like that?
No. Nothing of significance.
Okay.
No.
Are you doing anything to recruit Slo County high schoolers or, you know, folks that are at Cuesta? Are you making some some efforts in that regard?
Yeah, so we have some connections and people at Cuesta, and actually there is a chapter, I believe, that's trying to be started up at Cuesta. I'm trying to get in contact with them because I don't have a direct line of connection to them, but you know, so they're building their own chapter there, and definitely we've had some high schoolers who have kind of been interested, who have showed up at some of our events. You know, we have a couple of regulars, you know, kind of just, hey, what's events are going on? Like, you know, they just come and they show up, and that's been pretty cool. So great. We don't have like a ambassador program or anything like that, you know. Obviously, we'd love to expand, but, you know, right now we don't have – we've got a couple of people from both of those, though.
Great, great. Okay, so I know you guys have been very active the last month or so with events. You just hosted a really good event last weekend, didn't you, last week?
Yeah, gosh, man, time flies. I believe it was last week. It might have been the week before that. Mm-hmm. I believe it was last week.
And who was it that you brought to the campus?
Yeah, it was Shane Winnings.
Okay, and who is he exactly? Yeah.
So he's kind of like a Christian influencer. I forgot the name of his ministry, but he runs like this men's ministry, and so we brought him on. He kind of like a prove me wrong style thing. We were originally supposed to have another speaker on, but then unfortunately they had like a family emergency, so they had to switch it out, and so he was like we found out like the week before that
backup,
Shane was coming. Yeah.
What was his message? In 20 words or less.
His messaging was definitely stand strong in faith, you know, just kind of follow what it says in the Bible, and basically be very strong in those beliefs.
And how was the did you have a good turnout?
Yeah, we had a good turnout. I'd say we had a lot of people that were asking questions and, you know, people who were sitting there listening, and there was definitely some good engagement.
That's great. And then you got something coming up here in a week or so with Steve Hilton, correct?
Yes. So we're still figuring out the details, but we're on College Republican specifically. We were originally aiming to have a giant, like, every single candidate debate with both sides involved. And unfortunately, it, you know, there just wasn't enough time to get that kind of all figured out and kind of get like a platform where both sides could, you know, make it there. But, you know, Steve's campaign still really wanted to come to Cal Poly. And, you know, I do think it's very important for all candidates to kind of be able to be heard by the youth, because I think a lot of candidates are honestly skipping over the Gen Zers because they seem more disinterested. Mm-hmm. But I do, it is a big voting block. So, you know, if there's a candidacy that wants to come and, you know, bring their golden ticket with like Lieutenant Governor, the Controller, and the Attorney General, mm-hmm. which he's going to bring his whole team, and we wanted to see that happen. So he's going to be coming May 24th. And we're still figuring out the venue, but it's going to be somewhere around the Performing Arts Center area at the nighttime. So,
well, here's a side question: are you getting any of the local candidates for, you know, county office or count, you know, coming to you and wanting to meet with students to talk to them about the issues that they're involved in?
Yeah, so I know a lot of local candidates that kind of, you know, they've definitely been kind of coming on campus, mm-hmm. and talking about the vote. A lot of them actually they've worked with Cal Poly directly to just come and table on themselves, because they have a more of a capacity to table all the time by themselves, right, than, you know, us trying to juggle everyone. But we're definitely looking to hopefully expand into kind of having a program where we work directly with these candidates for the primaries and the is it the qualifying and the primaries? I always forget the second name.
Yeah. The general election.
General election and then the primaries.
Well, no, it's the other way around. Primaries and general election.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Okay. Yeah, the primaries are June 2nd.
Okay, yeah.
We're
aiming to hopefully get something for that. And then, you know, like work with some of the candidates, kind of building up to that. And then, obviously, for the general election as well.
And so... So what happens as far as your school year is coming up? So you're pretty much done. Are you heading back to the Riverside area to find work, or are you going to stay in the area and keep working with PPUSA and look for a job around here?
Yeah, so I definitely would love to stay in San Luis Obispo. Unfortunately, and a lot of Gen Zers feel this, they kind of have to go wherever the job opportunity is. We don't have the luxury of just staying in our hometown and keeping within the family. Like we kind of have to. I'm applying literally all over the country, so I could end up in Salt Lake. I could end up in the Bay Area. I could end up East Coast. I know for sure I'm not going to be able to end up in my hometown because there's no jobs there.
Yeah.
So,
do you have successor management lined up for at Cal Poly next year?
Yes. So we're actually, we have like two people that we're kind of like, we're trying to figure out like the positions right now, but we do have someone.
All right. Real quick, how can people follow you, follow TPUSA at Cal Poly?
Look up Cal Poly TPUSA on Instagram, follow us, give us a message, and we'll sign you up for our email link.
Well, Ryan, I'm happy to have you on for the first time, and hopefully even if you're out of town, I'll get you on to keep track of you as the radio, all right?
You'll see me around.
All right, Ryan, thank you. When we return, we'll be visiting with Stephen Moses, president of the Center for Long-Term Care Reform and visiting fellow at Paragon Health Institute. Stand by. We will be back.
Join us next Tuesday for Protect What Matters the Most with Barry Fisher. Send your questions and show topic ideas to barry@blazinbear.com.
Protecting what matters on the right choice, AM 1230, KPRL, 99.3 FM with Barry Fisher. Advice and information on protecting what matters most in today's world. Brought to you by Adler Belmont Insurance Brokers and their new associate, Heather Bordan, serving the commercial insurance needs of businesses on the Central Coast.
Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. PWM is the broadcast that helps you become better shoppers and buyers of services and products to protect various aspects of your life, health, and property. We also explore current events, our history, community, institutions, and local treasures that are notable and worth preserving. This hour's guest is Stephen Moses, president of the Center for Long-Term Care Reform and visiting fellow at Paragon Health. We're going to be talking about something that's been in the news constantly now for about the last 2 or 3 months, Medicaid fraud. And we're going to talk about what it is, why it's happening, and why it's bad for taxpayers, and most importantly, why it's not so great for the people who rely on Medicaid, and again, that's Medi-Cal here in California, for their health care. We're going to also then try to talk about something a little more positive after that, the latest research on aging well from Age Wave guru Ken Dykewald, and then insights into artificial intelligence and its increasing role in long-term care. Steve, welcome back to Protecting What Matters.
Thank you. Good to be with you again.
Good to have you. Just so the audience remembers, and so you and I can remember, you and I go back about 30 years, and we have probably been talking about government waste, fraud, and abuse for about 29 and a half years. And believe it or not, Steve, we have a caller, so stand by. Thanks for calling Protecting What Matters. What's your question?
Hi, I actually don't have a question, but I want to say thank you for having Ryan on.
Is this his mother?
It is not, but his mother and his family must be so proud of this young man. Well, and I want to tell him, I hope he's listening, thank you for giving this old lady some hope. Because, even if he's only a husband and a father, he's going to be successful. And anyway, thank you for having me.
Thank you for calling. I'm sure he'll hear that. So thank you so much. Yeah, you know, it's really, I have to say, and thank you for that call. I mean, Steve, you heard the tail end of our first guest, but I mean, it really is heartening to see a new generation of young people, you know, taking up the stuff that we were doing, you know, what, 50, 60 years ago in college and high school and that kind of stuff. So it is hard.
We need them.
Yes.
And we've made their generation much more difficult because of all the focus on the baby boomers.
So anyway, so Steve, you know, let's talk a little bit about you for a second, just to remind the audience. I call you a think tank guy. You've been a researcher and an advocate regarding long-term care and healthcare issues for, like I said, at least 30 or more years. Tell us a little bit about the Center for Long-Term Care Reform, how you got started in that, and then also tell us about your work at the Paragon Health Institute.
Sure. Well, my professional roots are actually in the federal government. I worked there for a number of years, specializing in Medicaid and long-term care issues especially. And I came across this phenomenon that although most people think of Medicaid as a welfare program that you have to impoverish yourself to qualify for, the way it actually works is to the advantage of middle-class and affluent people who can still qualify and preserve wealth and actually co-opt the best services Medicaid has to offer to the loss of the poor people Medicaid was supposed to serve. Well, that idea, that analysis, didn't go over big with my federal bosses, so I left government in 1989 and worked as director of research for a long-term care insurance company, making the case that long-term care insurance is hard to sell when the government is giving it away. We got some serious federal legislation passed in 1993 to close some loopholes and establish more incentives for people to plan for long-term care, but the job wasn't done. So when my company got bought by GE and I couldn't really do what I was doing with the media, my hands tied because of the sensitivity of the issues I was dealing with, I spun off and created the Center for Long-Term Care Reform, which is dedicated to ensuring access to quality long-term care for all Americans by encouraging alternatives in the private sector to the default position, which is basically doing nothing and ending up on Medicaid. So I created that organization along with a co-founder in 1998. We've been around for 28 years. And somewhere along the way, I met Brian Blaze, who's president of the Paragon Health Institute. And we got interested together in some of my issues. He brought me in to testify when he was working in Congress to the Oversight Committee. And we've been working on these issues together ever since. And for me, as a visiting fellow at Paragon, and I can't recommend Paragon enough for its creativity in the area of health reform of all kinds, not just long-term care.
You guys are doing some great research, and anybody that's interested in learning more about what's going on in our healthcare system, I highly recommend the Paragon Health Institute website. There's a wealth of knowledge. Let's talk a little bit about this Medicaid thing. Now, you know, Medicaid, yeah, I, you know me, I do a lot of research. I'm kind of a geek in that regard. But I looked at this, the history of the Medicaid program, and obviously it was, you know, for, again, it's Medi-Cal in California, and it was, you know, started about the same time, I believe at the same time as Medicare, correct, Steve?
Yes.
And it was a very, very, I want to say, limited program. But over this last, what is it now, 50 years, 60 years, they've tacked on so many other programs. that it's become probably unmanageable at this point. And in many regards, as we're finding, is it's rife with waste and fraud and abuse and it's really bankrupting the country. Tell us a little, give me your perspective of how Medicaid has evolved and what some of the biggest problems that we have today with it are.
Well, Medicaid is a perfect example of the old saying, good intentions often lead to bad results. The Medicaid program was set up in an, if not unique, a very unusual way, as a partnership between the federal government and the states. And the federal government sets the overall rules and regulations, but the states administer the program. And the funding for the program is really at the root of all the problems that we could talk about today. The way it's set up is that the states spend money on Medicaid services, and then the federal government comes in and reimburses the state, and it's a federal match that is at least 50-50. So the state spends $50, they get $50 back from the federal government. But it also gets much higher, to 85% of the cost returned to the state government. Now, because that financial spigot is wide open like that, the more states spend, the more they get back from the federal government. So why should you worry about having too many people on Medicaid, maybe some of them fraudulent, when it's bringing more money into the state and allowing you to pay for more services?
It's really an open-ended slush fund for politicians to be able to create classes of people who become dependents on the government and shift other and spend money elsewhere, right? I mean, isn't that really what it is?
It's an open invitation to bring more and more people onto Medicaid, which means they become dependent. And that has had disastrous consequences, especially in the area of long-term care, because Medicaid has paid for most long-term care since 1965, which has really sent the message, because of the way that it pays and handles eligibility, it reduced the incentive people would have to think about long-term care when they're young and healthy and affluent and might be able to plan for it or buy insurance the way they do for health care and their fire insurance and all the other potential catastrophes that could happen to them. But Medicaid kind of took long-term care off the table, and we're ending up with the consequences now of so many boomers getting older, getting to the point where they're going to need long-term care, and we lack programs that are sufficient to supply that care and pay it for it adequately.
Whose idea was this, Steve, at the federal level, that it was a good idea to have an open-ended entitlement program with no universal, you know, limits on the budget and what could money needed to be printed to just dole out to the states? How did that happen?
Well, as I said, it was well-intentioned despite the ultimate consequences. We were in a period of the Great Society, Lyndon Johnson and his cohorts, and we were going to have butter as well as bullets. We had the Vietnam War going, and yet we were trying to take war to poverty. We declared war on poverty, and poverty won is the unfortunate consequence.
So explain to me back, you know, you kind of, you on your, the Paragon website, you wrote an article back in, I want to say, July of 2024, entitled Medicaid's $100+ billion leak. And this was kind of a harbinger of what we were seeing now in many regards with all this fraud that's being uncovered. Could you want to run through what your primary points in this article were? Because I think it was a great article.
Well, thank you. Yeah, if I had to pick the one key thing of all the possibilities to fix Medicaid long-term care, this would be it. And it has to do with how people with wealth qualify for Medicaid, even though it's a program for the poor. There's two aspects of the eligibility determination. You have to have low income and you have to have low assets. You read about that all the time. It doesn't work anything like the way it's expressed, for example, by the New York Times in a column they did about dying broke. The way it really works is on the income side, you can have substantial income, $10,000 a month, if your private medical expenses or long-term care are comparable in size, because they deduct your private expenses from your income before asking if you're low income. Well, that's fine. You have to produce evidence, receipts. You've got to show you really did spend that money to get down to that level of income. But on the asset side, it's completely different. You don't have to spend down for long-term care or for medical expenses. You can spend down just by buying exempt assets. Well, what's exempt? Well, home equity up to over $1 million in most places, a car of unlimited value, a business, including the capital and cash flow of unlimited value, your tax-deferred retirement savings, and so on, all personal belongings and household furnishes, all totally exempt. So if you've got a few $100,000 and you want to qualify for Medicaid, you just use it to fix up the house or buy a new car or get some of this other stuff. Now, the next question would be, well, why would people who can have that kind of money want to go on Medicaid, which has such a terrible reputation for poor access and quality? Well, the answer is, in the elder law bar that specializes in artificially impoverishing people to put them on Medicaid will tell you this, don't use up all your money. Save some so you can start paying privately. So if you go to the nursing home or the home health agency, you are a private payer paying private pay rates, which are half again as much as what Medicaid pays. So they roll out the red carpet to get you. Guess what? You get in. Once you're in, you flip the switch, convert to Medicaid, and there's nothing they can do about it. Under state and federal law, they cannot kick you out just because your source of payment changed from private pay to Medicaid, even though it's bankrupting the health care providers. The effect of this is that the very best services that are available under Medicaid in the nicest neighborhoods and the best nursing homes get taken by the middle class and affluent. And the poor people who tend to live in the less desirable neighborhoods where the worst nursing homes and health care providers are, they end up getting the crumbs from the least of desirable services available through Medicaid. So what we need to do is change the rules on asset spend down. Yes, spend down, but show that you spent down for care and became part of the solution by paying privately for your long-term care instead of part of the problem by overloading Medicaid when, if it weren't for this crazy, mixed-up, corrupt, perverse incentive in the system, you would have planned early, bought some long-term care insurance from Barry Fisher, and not ended up in this fix.
So it seems to me, and I mean, we're coming up on a break here in a minute or a couple of minutes, so we're going to take this on to the next segment because this is fascinating. At least it is to me. But it seems to me that when I look at all this Medicaid fraud that's happening in the various different states, you know, yet some of it has to do a lot with hospice care, okay, which is supposed to be end-of-life palliative care. There's also this other aspect of it that a lot of the people don't have to go to nursing homes anymore to be paid for by Medicaid. There are home care waivers. And so for in-home support services, that can be and the caregiving can be self-directed to family members. So this has created a cottage industries of fake businesses that are sucking money out of the Medicaid system. I got to go to a break here, Steve, and I'm going to put you on hold, and I want to take up this topic on the other side of the break. So stay tuned. Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with Stephen Moses, president of the Center for Long-Term Care Reform and visiting fellow at the Paragon Health Institute. You can call in or text with questions, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. So we're talking here about some of the recent fraud that's been uncovered in Medicaid / Medi-Cal. And where some of it hits, and where Steve, so where it really hit in Los Angeles, these big arrests that they made in 447 hospices in Los Angeles last month. It used to be, I mean, when I first learned about hospice care, because again, it's part of the long-term care conversation, right? I always thought that in order to be able to receive hospice care, you had to be within 6 months of imminent death. Somewhere along the way, and then I started noticing, hearing about people who were getting hospice care for a year, for 2 years, for 3 years. How did this all change in the system? And then again, it morphed in the case of California, apparently, according to the indictments and all that. All of these, fake home care service or hospice services were charging the government but not really providing any care. How did this all happen?
Well, hospice is a Medicare service, and it's really a wonderful thing, and it's supposed to work the way you described it. Mm-hmm. When you're at the final months of your life, you get some special help, palliative care. I went through this with my late wife, who contracted brain cancer, a glioblastoma.
Mm-hmm.
And it was invaluable having the nurse come to the house, give us personal service, show me how to apply the injections that were needed. Anyway, wonderful service. Well, one day someone woke up in the federal government and realized that one-third of all the hospices in the United States were located in Los Angeles. Not California, just L.A., and they started looking at it, and what they found was that there were new hospices coming on the system constantly, and as they changed from simply paying the bills to withholding the funds until there was evidence that they were legitimate, that led to those cancellations that you referenced.
Mm-hmm.
The same kinds of problems are going on with general healthcare fraud, and specifically with long-term care.
Well, so a lot of that. So that goes back to the whole issue of, okay, we used to tell people, if you want to go on Medicaid and not buy long-term care insurance, you'll need to go to a nursing home. And nobody wants to go to a nursing home. Again, somewhere that changed, where people were able to get home care waivers and get their care at home through, and then lo and behold, in some states, I guess the big state here is Ohio, and the Daily Wire, I don't know if you follow the Daily Wire, they did a wonderful expose on this. If not, I'll find the link and I can send it to you. But basically in the state of Ohio, again, basically you're able to pay a family member to take care of you. And the point of the documentary was, well, family members are supposed to take care of you without getting paid. I mean, that was one of the points. And I mean, I get it. You know, it's hard on family caregivers to leave their job and then lose part of their life to take care of an aging loved one. But apparently, again, this was done on such an industrial scale in Ohio that there's, again, billions of dollars of fraud. So again, when did that all change in the system?
Well, it started to change, 35 or 40 years ago. Nobody wanted to go to a nursing home. Medicaid paid so little to the nursing homes back then that they had a terrible reputation for poor access and quality. That's a whole other story. But the researchers began to say, well, gee, why pay all that money to institutionalize people when you could do it so much less expensively if you just took care of them at home? So that began the transition to home and community-based services as an alternative to nursing home care, because the researchers insisted it must save money. Well, it does, maybe for some people for a while, but what we've found out as home and community-based care has gone from nothing to 87.9% of all long-term care provided by Medicaid nationally, we found that the people who get the home and community-based care and love it, it is definitely the preference, they end up eventually needing long-term care in a nursing home anyway as their condition deteriorates, so they end up costing more over the long run. This is one of the reasons why the total cost of home care and nursing home care has skyrocketed all along over the years. So the argument that somehow it was going to save money didn't hold. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't find a way to pay for it, but we're never going to find that way to pay for it through government programs that are always inadequately funded. What we have to do is find a way to wean the public off of this dependency, to get them thinking about long-term care early so that they pay privately for themselves and they have all of the wonderful options open to people who do pay privately.
So I do want to move on to Ken Dykewald's stuff because I think he's got some important things. But you know, where do you see, are you working on any stories? Is Paragon working on any stories? I know McKnight's is doing some good reporting on this as well. I mean, where do you see this Medicaid fraud story going from here? Do you think we're going to be seeing a lot more?
Wonderful that you asked. Yes, your listeners can go right now and Google Brian Blaze interviews Dr. Oz.
Okay.
Dr. Mehmet Oz, the administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. I just watched the interview myself this morning, and it's absolutely wonderful coverage of all the things that CMS is doing right now to find, control, and prosecute all of these fraud issues that we've talked about, the hospice, the general health care, the long-term care, and home and community-based services.
So, and by the way, folks, it's Brian Blaze, B-L-A-S-E, interviews Dr. Oz. I'm going to check that out. I'm sure it's a good interview. Were there any quick takeaways you'd like to share? What jumped out at you most, Steve, from the interview?
Well, It was just all around excellent. He made the point that, well, it's avoiding me, but I would just urge your listeners to check that out.
And you know,
one particular point, but I'm just not recalling.
Well, if you think about it, you can shift gears and say it. But you know, and again, a lot of this fraud. I mean, everybody made fun of the Doge program, but I think some of this, a lot of this, you know, the lid was lifted on a lot of this stuff during that, what, 2 or 3 month period when Doge was in operation. And really, it's also the use of AI and the speed of AI that's been able to uncover a lot of this fraud, correct?
Yeah, you know, it also has roots in COVID, where the whole idea was just throw money at it. And during the Biden administration in general, the attitude was not to program integrity and control costs. It was entirely get as many people on the programs as we can so that we can say that we have higher health insurance coverage than we really do. So only now are we beginning to turn it around to focus on spending the money properly.
You know,
I do capture this point. Dr. Oz made the point that what the Paragon Institute has called legalized money laundering, and this is where states, instead of investing their taxpayers' money to get federal matching funds for Medicaid, they go to providers or governmental entities, tax them to get extra money, and then leverage that up with the federal match, and then reimburse the sources that they taxed.
Mm-hmm.
It really is like legalized money laundering. But what he was saying is that, in a way, that's even worse than fraud.
Yes.
At least with fraud, you can go after it. It's remediable. But with the money laundering, it's done legally. And I think that, you know, that's a real parallel to what's going on in the Medicaid long-term care eligibility, where we actually let people with substantial wealth qualify and evade the spend-down requirement and get also the best care available because of the key money concept, pay privately for a while and you get the best care. That's legal, and it's almost like legalized fraud, which people often point out to me. How do they let this go on? And I say, well, I've been trying to stop it for 40 years. We've made a little progress here and there, but for the most part, it is wide open. And I was pointing out in making that observation that if we could just get Dr. Oz to look at that aspect of the issue, maybe we could get some results comparable to what's happening in the fraud area.
Well, and also, and a couple of other things come to mind, and then we will shift to Ken Dykewald here from my perspective. Number one, I'd like to see some enterprising investigative journalist start connecting the dots between these fraudulent providers of home care services or hospice services or whatever it is, and their political contributions to politicians in their states and local areas. I'm sure there's got to be a huge connection there, that because you're talking about money laundering and influence peddling and buying and all that kind of stuff. Number two, the other thing, and this brings it closer to home, as you probably know, in most states, the county is charged with providing the Medicaid services to its residents. And so a good portion of most county budgets are pass-through dollars from the feds and the state. And when this stuff starts getting and so those programs are being funded through nonprofits, NGOs, as it were. But the bottom line is this is going to have a real ripple effect at all levels of government, and particularly at the county level, because the federal government's got to stop. They're going to run out of money And they know it's going to happen. So I think that this is a real cautionary thing to count our county leaders here and our city leaders to not just expect this avalanche of dollars to continue to come in the door to pay for these services.
We're not going to run out of money. We ran out of money a long time ago. And every marginal dollar the federal government spends, it has to borrow, and that brings in the whole issue of what are we going to do when nobody wants to buy the bonds to fund those huge budget deficits?
Well, we're going to talk about that on the other side of the break real briefly. Let me move to Ken Dykewald, who I know, I mean, in a sense, I mean, I've seen you on panels with Dykewald before, if I'm not mistaken. And anybody who doesn't know who Ken Dykewald is has been sleeping for the last 30 or 40 years. He's a psychologist, gerontologist, and best-selling author of 19 books. And in his most prominent book, his first one, I believe, was Age Wave. He lives up in San Francisco, so sometimes I get a little cranky with some of his political views. But other than that, he does really great work in the areas of gerontology. You shared a couple of his articles in one of your most recent LTC newsletters. And so I'd like you to share, again, some of the highlights from that. You know, he says we're at a tipping point for liberating a new age of aging. So what are his takeaways on what we should be doing? Because everybody's lifespan is getting longer. We're living longer. We're not living more well necessarily, but we spend a boatload. We spend more than any other country on healthcare, and our outcomes are really bad. So what is he suggesting, Steve, that we ought to be focusing on?
Well, I followed Ken's work ever since that first book, Age Wave, that really turned me on to what's wrong with the government financing in the area of aging and long-term care. And Ken was the MC for a program we did with Paragon on long-term care and what's wrong with it and what can we do. But Ken's latest, everything he does is on the theme of making the most out of what's happening with aging. And now he's moved the terminology away from aging to longevity. How can we extend the health span, not just the lifespan? And he's talked for many years and does in this new book about how the aging process is changing. And we used to be, we would work hard, retire at 65, die by 70 or 75, and it was all over. Now it's just beginning when we get to the point of retirement. We may retire early but we may want to stay in the satisfying jobs we have, or if we leave them, start a whole new enterprise in the economy, or to volunteer, or go back to school and learn. And he points out how we have these cycles that we can go through that we really didn't have the time to do until the marvelous medical breakthroughs that have made it possible for us to live longer and have these options and choices.
So, and again, I mean, you make a really good point. It's that, you know, all of our social welfare systems, the Social Security, all those things, pension plans, the huge pension plans, they weren't designed for us to live this long, were they?
No, and that hasn't been as much Ken's focus, the financing, as I wish it would be, but we are really about to hit a fiscal wall. We have sent the message to the public since 1935 that you don't have to worry about retirement. We've got Social Security. And since 1965 that you don't have to worry about health care because we've got Medicare. And about long-term care, no worries, we've got Medicaid. And the irony is that well-intentioned promise desensitized the public to personal risk, so they have ignored the need to plan individually in too many cases. And the irony is, just as we get to the point with the baby boom generation that they need the props, the supports, the promises that the government has made, they are at risk. And we have in the 2030s, it really hits the fan, because that's when the baby boomers start turning 85, which is the key age for health care and long-term care expenses skyrocketing. And that's the same decade in which Social Security and Medicare run out of their trust funds, such as they are, and just have to cut back substantially unless somehow a solution is found.
All right. Well, you know, Steve, you are perfectly timed to the bumper music. I'm going to put you on hold this time as opposed to dropping you. Sorry about that. We'll be back in about 3 minutes, folks, with Steve Moses, and we're going to wrap up on some of the financial issues that Steve was just alluding to and how we're going to survive our current fiscal issues. So stand by. Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with Steve Moses, president of the Center for Long-Term Care Reform and visiting fellow for Paragon Health Institute. You can call in or text with questions, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. I want to mention again the RP Slow Rededicate 250 event that's happening this Sunday. It's from 1 to 3, I think it's like 1 to 3 p.m. So, and you can get more information on this. It should be a great event. There's going to be a lot of people there. You're going to want to meet, you know, your neighbors, a lot of the candidates and all that type of thing. You can get more information at rpsloc.org/events. Okay, and then finally, next week, before we get back to Steve, Joe Hamm is the gentleman. He's an author of a book called The Social Media Matrix, and he explains in really clear terms how social media is really messing with us. And I've discovered him, and I'm really looking forward to have him on. And then Greg Haskin, who's our executive director of CoLab, of course, so we'll be talking about county issues and upcoming elections and all that type of thing. So, Steve, one of the reasons why I think it's so important for us to get a grip on this wasteful spending in all of our entitlement programs, okay, Medicare, Medicaid, anything else, is this country is going to hit a fiscal wall. And you shared several articles about a week ago, one from Henry Paulson, who's the former Secretary of the Treasury, who talks about how we're almost at a crash point with our bonds in the United States, which is what funds all these entitlements. You also shared a great article from American Enterprise Institute written by Mark Warshawski on the fact that if the government does not do something about the Social Security Trust Fund in 2033, we're all going to take about a 20% hit on our Social Security because the system is going broke and because we don't have enough people working and the baby boom is going through the python. So summarize how all this is going to play out in relationship to all this waste, fraud, and abuse that we're seeing.
Well, nobody knows how it's going to play out. We're kind of watching the drama now, and we have tiptoed up to the edge of a fiscal cliff with the national debt approaching $40 trillion and the servicing of the debt becoming almost impossible, $1 trillion or more, just to pay the interest on the debt we have. Now imagine if your family was in a fix like that, where your credit card bills were so high that you actually have to borrow money to make the minimum monthly payment. That's the state that the federal government is in right now. Social Security specifically, Mark Warshawski's paper on that was very good, but his solution is to means test Social Security, to make it more like Medicaid, a welfare program. And that scares me because it used to be we had welfare programs and social insurance programs, and social insurance supposedly had the dignity of private insurance. You paid into it and you got something back. It never really worked like that. It was always a pay-as-you-go system, charging current workers to pay older workers, but at least that was our intent. Well, we're turning those programs, Social Security and Medicare, into welfare programs at the same time, ironically, that we're changing the welfare programs, Medicaid and Supplemental Security Income, into entitlements by making them available to the middle class and affluent. The whole system is insane. We need people like Dr. Oz at CMS who are looking clearly and freshly at this problem to confront it. And at least they're doing that for fraud. I would love to get them as equally attentive to the issues we've talked about on the call.
So on Social Security, I mean, aren't there some actuarial fixes that can be put in place to soften some of these issues, like increasing the retirement age for younger people, you know, people that are, you know, still in the workforce, 40 years old, 40, you know, so they still have time to plan. Wouldn't that kind of thing do something to help the Social Security system?
Well, we tried that back in 1983 and moved the age of retirement from 65 out to 67 gradually over a period of time. But here we are with the same fix with only a few years to go before the trust fund, which is phony anyway. It's just an accounting gimmick. All the extra cost of Social Security has to come out of the general funds. We could raise the age of eligibility for Social Security and Medicare, but according to Washansky, we don't get enough of the solution from that. So we have to do other things that are really unfortunate. And the real tragedy is that we've let it go this so long that we kicked the can down the road.
Yeah,
so we're really stuck.
I've often said that if insurance companies ran their companies like our politicians run our government, they'd be perp walking those guys out the door, those government guys out the door.
Exactly.
All right, Steve, it's always a pleasure to have you on and to talk to you. We'll have you back soon. I think there's going to be a lot more to talk about in the coming months. So thank you so much. Folks, thank you. Thanks, Steve. Folks, thanks for joining us today. I'll see you next week with author Joe Hamm and Greg Haskett. So enjoy the rest of your week. Great weather.
Join us next Tuesday for Protect What Matters the Most with Barry Fisher. Send your questions and show topic ideas to Barry at blazonbear.com.